Chapter 8 Constant Capital and Variable Capital. The various factors of the labour process play different parts in forming the value of the product. The labourer adds fresh value to the subject of his labour by expending upon it a given amount of additional labour, no matter what the specific character and utility of that labour may be. On the other hand, the values of the means of production used up in the process are preserved and present themselves afresh as constituent parts of the value of the product. The values of the cotton and the spindle, for instance, reappear again in the value of the yarn. The value of the means of production is therefore preserved by being transferred to the product. This transfer takes place during the conversion of those means into a product, or in other words, during the labour process. It is brought about by labour. But how? The labourer does not perform two operations at once, one in order to add value to the cotton, the other in order to preserve the value of the means of production, or, what amounts to the same thing, to transfer to the yarn, to the product, the value of the cotton on which he works, and part of the value of the spindle with which he works. But, by the very act of adding new value, he preserves their former values. Since, however, the addition of new value to the subject of his labour and the preservation of its former value are two entirely distinct results, produced simultaneously by the labourer during one operation, it is plain that this twofold nature of the result can be explained only by the twofold nature of his labour. At one and the same time, it must in one character create value, and in another character preserve or transfer value. Now, in what manner does every labourer add new labour and consequently new value? Evidently, only by labouring productively in a particular way. The spinner by spinning, the weaver by weaving, the smith by forging. But, while thus incorporating labour generally, that is, value, it is by the particular form alone of the labour, by the spinning, the weaving, and the forging respectively, that the means of production, the cotton and spindle, the yarn and loom, and the iron and anvil, become constituent elements of the product, of a new use value. Footnote. Labour gives a new creation for one extinguished. An Essay on the Political Economy of Nations, London, 1821. End of footnote. Each use value disappears, but only to reappear under a new form in a new use value. Now we saw, when we were considering the process of creating value, that if a use value be effectively consumed in the production of a new use value, the quantity of labour expended in the production of the consumed article forms a portion of the quantity of labour necessary to produce the new use value. This portion is therefore labour transferred from the means of production to the new product. Hence the labourer preserves the values of the consumed means of production, or transfers them as portions of its value to the product, not by virtue of his additional labour, abstractedly considered, but by virtue of the particular useful character of that labour, by virtue of its special productive form. In so far, then, as labour is such specific productive activity, in so far as it is spinning, weaving, or forging, it raises, by mere contact, the means of production from the dead, makes them living factors of the labour process, and combines with them to form the new products. If the special productive labour of the workman were not spinning, he could not convert the cotton into yarn, and therefore could not transfer the values of the cotton and spindle to the yarn. Suppose the same workman, were to change his occupation to that of a joiner. He would still, by a day's labour, add value to the material he works upon. Consequently, we see, first, that the addition of new value takes place not by virtue of his labour being spinning in particular, or joinering in particular, but because it is labour in the abstract, a portion of the total labour of society. And we see next that the value added is of a given definite amount, not because his labour has a special utility, but because it is exerted for a definite time. On the one hand, then, it is by virtue of its general character, as being expenditure of human labour power in the abstract, that spinning adds new value to the values of the cotton and the spindle. And on the other hand, it is by virtue of its special character as being a concrete, useful process, that the same labour of spinning both transfers the values of the means of production to the product and preserves them in the product. Hence, at one and the same time, there is produced a twofold result. By the simple addition of a certain quantity of labour, new value is added. And by the quality of this added labour, the original values of the means of production are preserved in the product. This twofold effect, resulting from the twofold character of labour, may be traced in various phenomena. Let us assume that some invention enables the spinner to spin as much cotton in 6 hours as he was able to spin before in 36 hours. His labour is now 6 times as effective as it was for the purposes of useful production. The product of 6 hours' work has increased sixfold from £6 to £36. But now the 36 pounds of cotton absorb only the same amount of labour as formerly did the 6 pounds. 1/6 as much new labour is absorbed by each pound of cotton, and consequently the value added by the labour to each pound is only 1/6 of what it formerly was. On the other hand, in the product, in the 36 pounds of yarn, the value transferred from the cotton is 6 times as great as before. By the 6 hours spinning, the value of the raw material preserved and transferred to the product is 6 times as great as before, although the new value added by the labour of the spinner to each pound of the very same raw material is 1/6 what it was formerly. This shows that the two properties of labour, by virtue of which it is enabled in one case to preserve value and in the other to create value, are essentially different. On the one hand, the longer the time necessary to spin a given weight of cotton into yarn, the greater is the new value added to the material. On the other hand, the greater the weight of the cotton spun in a given time, the greater is the value preserved by being transferred from it to the product. Let us now assume that the productiveness of the spinner's labour, instead of varying, remains constant, that he therefore requires the same time as he formerly did to convert 1 pound of cotton into yarn, but that the exchange value of the cotton varies, either by rising to 6 times its former value or falling to 1/6 of that value. In both these cases, the spinner puts the same quantity of labour into a pound of cotton, and therefore adds as much value as he did before the change in value. He also produces a given weight of yarn in the same time as he did before. Nevertheless, the value that he transfers from the cotton to the yarn is either 1/6 of what it was before the variation, or, as the case may be, 6 times as much as before. The same result occurs when the value of the instruments of labour rises or falls, while their useful efficacy in the process remains unaltered. Again, if the technical conditions of the spinning process remain unchanged, and no change of value takes place in the means of production, the spinner continues to consume in equal working times equal quantities of raw material, and equal quantities of machinery, of unvarying value. The value that he preserves in the product is directly proportional to the new value that he adds to the product. In 2 weeks, he incorporates twice as much labor, and therefore twice as much value as in 1 week, and during the same time he consumes twice as much material and wears out twice as much machinery, of double the value in each case. He therefore preserves, in the product of 2 weeks, twice as much value as in the product of 1 week. So long as the conditions of production remain the same, the more value the laborer adds by fresh labor, the more value he transfers and preserves. But he does so merely because this addition of new value takes place under conditions that have not varied and are independent of his own labor. Of course, it may be said in one sense that the laborer preserves old value always in proportion to the quantity of new value that he adds. Whether the value of cotton rise from 1 shilling to 2 shillings, or fall to 6 pence, the workman invariably preserves in the product of 1 hour only 1/2 as much value as he preserves in 2 hours. In like manner, if the productiveness of his own labor varies by rising or falling, he will in 1 hour spin either more or less cotton, as the case may be, than he did before, and will consequently preserve in the product of 1 hour more or less value of cotton. But all the same, he will preserve by 2 hours' labor twice as much value as he will by one. Value exists only in articles of utility, in objects. We leave out of consideration its purely symbolical representation by tokens. Man himself, viewed as the impersonation of labor power, is a natural object, a thing, although a living conscious thing, and labor is the manifestation of this power residing in him. If, therefore, an article loses its utility, it also loses its value. The reason why means of production do not lose their value, at the same time that they lose their use value, is this. They lose in the labor process the original form of their use value, only to assume in the product the form of a new use value. But however important it may be to value that it should have some object of utility to embody itself in, yet it is a matter of complete indifference what particular object serves its purpose. This we saw when treating of the metamorphosis of commodities. Hence it follows that in the labor process the means of production transfer their value to the product only so far as, along with their use value, they lose also their exchange value. They give up to the product that value alone which they themselves lose as means of production. But in this respect, the material factors of the labor process do not all behave alike. The coal, burnt under the boiler, vanishes without leaving a trace. So too the tallow, with which the axles of wheels are greased. Dyestuffs and other auxiliary substances also vanish, but reappear as properties of the product. Raw material forms the substance of the product, but only after it has changed its form. Hence raw material and auxiliary substances lose the characteristic form with which they are clothed on entering the labor process. It is otherwise with the instruments of labor. Tools, machines, workshops, and vessels are of use in the labor process only so long as they retain their original shape, and are ready each morning to renew the process with their shape unchanged. And just as during their lifetime, that is to say, during the continued labor process in which they serve, they retain their shape independent of the product, so too they do after their death. The corpses of machines, tools, workshops, etc., are always separate and distinct from the product they help to turn out. If we now consider the case of any instrument of labour during the whole period of its service, from the day of its entry into the workshop till the day of its banishment into the lumber room, we find that during this period its use value has been completely consumed, and therefore its exchange value completely transferred to the product. For instance, if a spinning machine lasts for 10 years, it is plain that during that working period its total value is gradually transferred to the product of the 10 years. The lifetime of an instrument of labour, therefore, is spent in the repetition of a greater or less number of similar operations. Its life may be compared with that of a human being. Every day brings a man 24 hours nearer to his grave. But how many days he has still to travel on that road, no man can tell accurately by merely looking at him. This difficulty, however, does not prevent life insurance offices from drawing, by means of the theory of averages, very accurate, and at the same time very profitable, conclusions. So it is with the instruments of labour. It is known by experience how long, on the average, a machine of a particular kind will last. Suppose its use value in the labour process to last only 6 days. Then, on the average, it loses each day 1/6 of its use value, and therefore parts with 1/6 of its value to the daily product. The wear and tear of all instruments, their daily loss of use value, and the corresponding quantity of value they part with to the product, are accordingly calculated upon this basis. It is thus strikingly clear that means of production never transfer more value to the product than they themselves lose during the labour process by the destruction of their own use value. If such an instrument has no value to lose, if, in other words, it is not the product of human labour, it transfers no value to the product. It helps to create use value without contributing to the formation of exchange value. In this class are included all means of production supplied by nature without human assistance, such as land, wind, water, metals in situ, and timber in virgin forests. Yet another interesting phenomenon here presents itself. Suppose a machine to be worth £1,000 and to wear out in 1,000 days. Then 1/1000th part of the value of the machine is daily transferred to the day's product. At the same time, though with diminishing vitality, the machine as a whole continues to take part in the labour process. Thus it appears that one factor of the labour process, a means of production, continually enters as a whole into that process, while it enters into the process of the formation of value by fractions only. The difference between the two processes is here reflected in their material factors, by the same instrument of production taking part as a whole in the labour process, while at the same time, as an element in the formation of value, it enters only by fractions. Footnote. The subject of repairs of the implements of labour does not concern us here. A machine that is undergoing repair no longer plays the part of an instrument, but that of a subject of labour. Work is no longer done with it, but upon it. It is quite permissible for our purpose to assume that the labour expended on the repairs of instruments is included in the labour necessary for their original production. But in the text we deal with that wear and tear, which no doctor can cure, and which little by little brings about death, with that kind of wear which cannot be repaired from time to time, and which, in the case of a knife, would ultimately reduce it to a state in which the cutler would say of it, "It is not worth a new blade." We have shown in the text that a machine takes part in every labour process as an integral machine, but that into the simultaneous process of creating value, it enters only bit by bit. How great, then, is the confusion of ideas exhibited in the following extract. Mr. Ricardo says a portion of the labour of the engineer in making stocking machines is contained, for example, in the value of a pair of stockings. Yet the total labour that produced each single pair of stockings includes the whole labour of the engineer, not a portion, for one machine makes many pairs, and none of those pairs could have been done without any part of the machine. The author, an uncommonly self-satisfied wiseacre, is right in his confusion, and therefore in his contention, to this extent only, that neither Ricardo nor any other economist, before or since him, has accurately distinguished the two aspects of labour, and still less, therefore, the part played by it under each of these aspects in the formation of value. End of footnote. On the other hand, a means of production may take part as a whole in the formation of value, while into the labour process it enters only bit by bit. Suppose that in spinning cotton, the waste for every £115 used amounts to £15, which is converted not into yarn, but into devil's dust. Now, although this £15 of cotton never becomes a constituent element of the yarn, yet assuming this amount of waste to be normal and inevitable under average conditions of spinning, its value is just as surely transferred to the value of the yarn as is the value of the £100 that forms the substance of the yarn. The use value of £15 of cotton must vanish into dust before £100 of yarn can be made. The destruction of this cotton is therefore a necessary condition in the production of the yarn. And because it is a necessary condition, and for no other reason, the value of that cotton is transferred to the product. The same holds good for every kind of refuse resulting from a labour process, so far at least as such, refuse cannot be further employed as a means in the production of new and independent use values. Such an employment of refuse may be seen in the large machine works at Manchester, where mountains of iron turnings are carted away to the foundry in the evening, in order the next morning to reappear in the workshops as solid masses of iron. We have seen that the means of production transfer value to the new product, so far only as during the labour process they lose value in the shape of their old use value. The maximum loss of value that they can suffer in the process is plainly limited by the amount of the original value with which they came into the process, or in other words, by the labour time necessary for their production. Therefore, the means of production can never add more value to the product than they themselves possess independently of the process in which they assist. However useful a given kind of raw material, or a machine, or other means of production may be, though it may cost £150, or, say, 500 days' labour, yet it cannot, under any circumstances, add to the value of the product more than £150. Its value is determined not by the labour process into which it enters as a means of production, but by that out of which it has issued as a product. In the labour process, it only serves as a mere use value, a thing with useful properties, and could not, therefore, transfer any value to the product unless it possessed such value previously. Footnote. From this we may judge of the absurdity of J.B. Say, who pretends to account for surplus value, interest, profit, rent, by the service productif, which the means of production, soil, instruments, and raw material, render in the labour process by means of their use values. Mr. Wilhelm Roscher, who seldom loses an occasion of registering, in black and white, ingenious apologetic fancies, records the following specimen. J.B. Say very truly remarks, "The value produced by an oil mill, after deduction of all costs, is something new, something quite different from the labour by which the oil mill itself was erected." Very true, Mr. Professor. The oil produced by the oil mill is indeed something very different from the labour expended in constructing the mill. By value, Mr. Roscher understands such stuff as oil, because oil has value, notwithstanding that nature produces petroleum, though relatively, in small quantities, a fact to which he seems to refer in his further observation, "It, nature, produces scarcely any exchange value." Mr. Roscher's nature and the exchange value it produces are rather like the foolish virgin, who admitted indeed that she had had a child, but it was such a little one. This savant sérieux, in continuation, remarks, "Ricardo's school is in the habit of including capital as accumulated labour under the head of labour. This is unskilful work, because, indeed, the owner of capital, after all, does something more than merely creating and preserving of the same, namely, the abstention from the enjoyment of it, for which he demands, for example, interest." How very skilful is this anatomico-physiological method of political economy, which, indeed, converts a mere desire, after all, into a source of value. End of footnote. While productive labour is changing the means of production into constituent elements of a new product, their value undergoes a metempsychosis. It deserts the consumed body to occupy the newly created one. But this transmigration takes place, as it were, behind the back of the labourer. He is unable to add new labour, to create new value, without at the same time preserving old values. And this because the labour he adds must be of a specific, useful kind. And he cannot do work of a useful kind without employing products as the means of production of a new product, and thereby transferring their value to the new product. The property, therefore, which labour power in action, living labour, possesses of preserving value at the same time that it adds it, is a gift of nature which costs the labourer nothing, but which is very advantageous to the capitalist inasmuch as it preserves the existing value of his capital. Footnote. Of all the instruments of the farmer's trade, the labour of man is that on which he is most to rely for the repayment of his capital. The other two, the working stock of the cattle, and the carts, ploughs, spades, and so on, without a given portion of the first, are nothing at all. Edmund Burke, Thoughts and Details on Scarcity. Originally presented to the Right Honourable William Pitt in the month of November 1795. End of footnote. So long as trade is good, the capitalist is too much absorbed in money-grubbing to take notice of this gratuitous gift of labour. A violent interruption of the labour process by a crisis makes him sensitively aware of it. Footnote. In the Times of the 26th of November, 1862, a manufacturer whose mill employed 800 hands and consumed on the average 150 bales of East Indian or 130 bales of American cotton, complains in a doleful manner of the standing expenses of his factory when not working. He estimates them at £6,000 a year. Among them are a number of items that do not concern us here, such as rent, rates and taxes, insurance, salaries of the manager, bookkeeper, engineer, and others. Then he reckons £150 for coal, used to heat the mill occasionally and run the engine now and then. Besides this, he includes the wages of the people employed at odd times to keep the machinery in working order. Lastly, he puts down £1,200 for depreciation of machinery, because the weather and the natural principle of decay do not suspend their operations because the steam engine ceases to revolve. He says, emphatically, he does not estimate his depreciation at more than the small sum of £1,200, because his machinery is already nearly worn out. End of footnote. As regards the means of production, what is really consumed is their use value, and the consumption of this use value by labour results in the product. There is no consumption of their value, and it would therefore be inaccurate to say that it is reproduced. Footnote. Productive consumption, where the consumption of a commodity is a part of the process of production, in these instances there is no consumption of value. S. P. Newman. End of footnote. It is rather preserved, not by reason of any operation it undergoes itself in the process, but because the article in which it originally exists vanishes, it's true, but vanishes into some other article. Hence, in the value of the product, there is a reappearance of the value of the means of production, but there is, strictly speaking, no reproduction of that value. That which is produced is a new use value, in which the old exchange value reappears. Footnote. In an American compendium that has gone through perhaps 20 editions, this passage occurs. It matters not in what form capital reappears. Then, after a lengthy enumeration of all the possible ingredients of production whose value reappears in the product, the passage concludes thus. The various kinds of food, clothing, and shelter necessary for the existence and comfort of the human being are also changed. They are consumed from time to time, and their value reappears in that new vigour imparted to his body and mind, forming fresh capital to be employed again in the work of production. F. Wayland. Without noticing any other oddities, it suffices to observe that what reappears in the fresh vigour is not the bread's price, but its blood-forming substances. What, on the other hand, reappears in the value of that vigour is not the means of subsistence, but their value. The same necessaries of life, at half the price, would form just as much muscle and bone, just as much vigour, but not vigour of the same value. This confusion of value and vigour, coupled with our author's pharisaical indefiniteness, mark an attempt, futile for all that, to thrash out an explanation of surplus value from a mere reappearance of pre-existing values. End of footnote. It is otherwise with the subjective factor of the labour process, with labour power in action. While the labourer, by virtue of his labour being of a specialised kind that has a special object, preserves and transfers to the product the value of the means of production, he at the same time, by the mere act of working, creates each instant an additional or new value. Suppose the process of production to be stopped just when the workman has produced an equivalent for the value of his own labour power, when, for example, by 6 hours' labour, he has added a value of 3 shillings. This value is the surplus of the total value of the product over the portion of its value that is due to the means of production. It is the only original bit of value formed during this process, the only portion of the value of the product created by this process. Of course, we do not forget that this new value only replaces the money advanced by the capitalist in the purchase of the labour power, and spent by the labourer on the necessaries of life. With regard to the money spent, the new value is merely a reproduction, but nevertheless it is an actual, and not, as in the case of the value of the means of production, only an apparent reproduction. The substitution of one value for another is here effected by the creation of new value. We know, however, from what has gone before, that the labour process may continue beyond the time necessary to reproduce and incorporate in the product a mere equivalent for the value of the labour power. Instead of the 6 hours that are sufficient for the latter purpose, the process may continue for 12 hours. The action of labour power, therefore, not only reproduces its own value, but produces value over and above it. This surplus value is the difference between the value of the product and the value of the elements consumed in the formation of that product. In other words, of the means of production and the labour power. By our explanation of the different parts played by the various factors of the labour process in the formation of the product's value, we have, in fact, disclosed the characters of the different functions allotted to the different elements of capital in the process of expanding its own value. The surplus of the total value of the product over the sum of the values of its constituent factors is the surplus of the expanded capital over the capital originally advanced. The means of production on the one hand, labour power on the other, are merely the different modes of existence which the value of the original capital assumed when from being money it was transformed into the various factors of the labour process. That part of capital, then, which is represented by the means of production, by the raw material, auxiliary material, and the instruments of labour, does not, in the process of production, undergo any quantitative alteration of value. I therefore call it the constant part of capital, or more shortly, constant capital. On the other hand, that part of capital represented by labour power does, in the process of production, undergo an alteration of value. It both reproduces the equivalent of its own value, and also produces an excess, a surplus value, which may itself vary, maybe more or less, according to circumstances. This part of capital is continually being transformed from a constant into a variable magnitude. I therefore call it the variable part of capital, or shortly, variable capital. The same elements of capital which, from the point of view of the labour process, present themselves respectively as the objective and subjective factors, as means of production and labour power, present themselves from the point of view of the process of creating surplus value as constant and variable capital. The definition of constant capital thus given by no means excludes the possibility of a change of value in its elements. Suppose the price of cotton to be one day 6d a pound, and the next day, in consequence of a failure of the cotton crop, 1d a pound. Each pound of the cotton bought at 6d and worked up after the rise in value transfers to the product a value of 1d, and the cotton already spun before the rise, and perhaps circulating in the market as yarn, likewise transfers to the product twice its original value. It is plain, however, that these changes of value are independent of the increment or surplus value added to the value of the cotton by the spinning itself. If the old cotton had never been spun, it could, after the rise, be resold at 1d a pound instead of at 6d. Further, the fewer the processes the cotton has gone through, the more certain is the result. We therefore find that speculators make it a rule, when such sudden changes in value occur, to speculate in that material on which the least possible quantity of labour has been spent. To speculate, therefore, in yarn rather than in cloth, in cotton itself rather than in yarn. The change of value in the case we have been considering originates not in the process in which the cotton plays the part of a means of production, and in which it therefore functions as constant capital, but in the process in which the cotton itself is produced. The value of a commodity, it is true, is determined by the quantity of labour contained in it, but this quantity is itself limited by social conditions. If the time socially necessary for the production of any commodity alters, and a given weight of cotton represents, after a bad harvest, more labour than after a good one, all previously existing commodities of the same class are affected, because they are, as it were, only individuals of the species, and their value at any given time is measured by the labour socially necessary, that is, by the labour necessary for their production under the then existing social conditions. Footnote. Properly speaking, all products of the same kind form a single mass, and their price is determined in general and without regard to particular circumstances. Le Trône. End of footnote. As the value of the raw material may change, so too may that of the instruments of labour, of the machinery, etc., employed in the process, and consequently that portion of the value of the product transferred to it from them may also change. If, in consequence of a new invention, machinery of a particular kind can be produced by a diminished expenditure of labour, the old machinery becomes depreciated more or less, and consequently transfers so much less value to the product. But here again, the change in value originates outside the process in which the machine is acting as a means of production. Once engaged in this process, the machine cannot transfer more value than it possesses apart from the process. Just as a change in the value of the means of production, even after they have commenced to take a part in the labour process, does not alter their character as constant capital, so too a change in the proportion of constant to variable capital does not affect the respective functions of these two kinds of capital. The technical conditions of the labour process may be revolutionised to such an extent that where formerly 10 men, using 10 implements of small value, worked up a relatively small quantity of raw material, one man may now, with the aid of one expensive machine, work up 100 times as much raw material. In the latter case, we have an enormous increase in the constant capital that is represented by the total value of the means of production used, and at the same time a great reduction in the variable capital invested in labour power. Such a revolution, however, alters only the quantitative relation between the constant and the variable capital, or the proportions in which the total capital is split up into its constant and variable constituents. It has not in the least degree affected the essential difference between the two.